Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I'm now in Leviticus chapter 18. We're going to cover the whole chapter, verses 1 through 30, and talk about unlawful sexual relations, sexual perversions. Our context is this. In the last chapter, chapter 17, we covered miscellaneous laws about the place of sacrifice, which is namely at the tent of meeting, at the bronze altar in the courtyard there, and also the prohibition against eating of blood, which emphasizes how important blood was in the temple, in the tabernacle ritual. So now let's go to Leviticus 18, 1 through 5 and begin. Verse 1. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, I am the Lord your God. You shall not do what is done in the land of Egypt where you lived, nor are you to do what is done in the land of Canaan where I am bringing you. You shall not walk in their statutes. You are to perform my judgments and keep my statutes, to live in accord with them. I am the Lord your God. So you shall keep my statutes and my judgments by which a man may live if he does them. I am the Lord." Now here God is trying to protect the Israelites from their pagan neighbors where they used to be in Egypt, and also from their pagan neighbors where they're going to be in the land of Canaan. Because pagans are pagans, they basically do the same pagan perversions the same way that pagans do today in America or any other place in the world. Now, chapters 18, 19, and 20 are a little bit different than what we've gone through before, because these chapters concern personal morality. The previous chapters concern ritual violations and ritual prohibitions and sanctions and instructions and so forth. But now we're going to talk about some real down-to-earth personal sin. Now, God starts this off by saying, "I am the Lord your God. I am Yahweh your God." This phrase occurs 42 times in chapters 18 through 26, and I guess it's because he wants to reveal his authority before he starts telling people how they're supposed to behave, because they need that authority, because people are so sinful, so rebellious against even decent common morality. As the NIV Study Bible puts it, quote, "The Lord's name, i.e. his revealed character as Yahweh, the capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D Lord, his revealed character, Yahweh, the Lord, is the authority that stands behind his instructions. God has a right to rule over them, and he has a right to command what he pleases." Now, this is emphasized, this "I am the Lord your God," this is emphasized because God's laws were very much different than the laws of the pagan neighbors of the Israelites. And, of course, the human tendency is to assimilate to your culture, compromise with your culture, and do what your neighbors are doing. But God just keeps screaming out against that. No, "I am the Lord your God. You're not to do what is done in the land of Egypt," or what's done in the land of Canaan, as verse 3 says. That would be the worshiping of demons and beasts. That was already prohibited in Leviticus 17:7, by the way, last chapter. But just typically worshiping demons, worshiping animals. And that's the idolatrous things that the pagan neighbors were doing, also the immoral abominations, which we're going to talk about in chapters 18 and 19, starting with sexual perversions and depravity. Now, it's interesting. God tells the Israelites not to do what is done in the land of Egypt, or to do what is done in the land of Canaan. Six times in this one chapter, chapter 18, six times in this chapter, Israelites are told not to follow the example of their pagan neighbors. Happened twice in verse 3. Don't do what Egypt does. Don't do what Canaan does. And also in verses 24, 26, 27, 30, which we'll get to shortly, I'll point it out to you again. The whole point of this is, just because your neighbors are doing it doesn't mean you have to do it. Just because your neighbors are watching pornography or engaged in thruples or sadomasochism or anal sex or whatever the heck they're doing doesn't mean you have to do it. I mean, think about what Egypt did. God says, don't do what was done in the land of Egypt. Well, the famous Cleopatra was married to her brother, incest. Jameson Fawcett Brown says that even the Egyptians openly sanctioned marriages between parents and their children. That's pretty disgusting. Even by today's American Sodom and Gomorrah standards, that's disgusting. Now, verse 5 says, if you keep my statutes and my judgments, you will live. Now, that's an interesting verse. It's quoted a lot in the Old Testament. Let's start there. Ezekiel 20:11, I gave them my statutes and informed them of my ordinances, by which if a man observes them, he will live. Ezekiel 20:13, but the house of Israel rebelled against me in the wilderness. They did not walk in my statutes, and they rejected my ordinances, by which if a man observes them, he will live. Ezekiel 20:21. But the children rebelled against me. They did not walk in my statutes, nor were they careful to observe my ordinances, by which, if a man observes them, he will live. Nehemiah 9:29. And admonish them in order to turn them back to your law. Yet they acted arrogantly and did not listen to your commandments, but sinned against your ordinances, by which, if a man observes them, he shall live. Deuteronomy 30:20. By loving the Lord your God, by obeying his voice, and by holding fast to him, for this is your life, and the length of your days, that you may live in the land which the Lord swore to your fathers. Now, what does that mean, live? Obey the statutes so that you may live. I don't believe it's talking about spiritual life. These verses were not a way of salvation for the lost, as the NIV Study Bible points out. The laws here are referring to physical life. I'll make the case for that in just a minute. It's talking about physical life. You obey the laws, you will live physically. Now, as far as spiritual life, it was faith that got you spiritual life in the Old Testament. Before the law, Abraham lived by faith, Genesis 15:6. Abram believed the Lord, and he credited it to him as righteousness, one of the most quoted Old Testament verses in the Scriptures, of course. And that's talking about spiritual life, by believing in God, faith. Let's look at how this verse here in Leviticus 18:5 is quoted in the New Testament, and showing how in the New Testament, observing the law that you shall live by the statutes of the law, it is referred to spiritual life. In other words, it's an application from physical life moving on to spiritual life. Romans 10:5, for Moses writes that the man who practices the righteousness which is based on law shall live by that righteousness. That's quoting Leviticus 18:5. But then, of course, Paul goes on to say that we can't keep the righteousness based on law. Romans 10:6-8. But the righteousness that comes from faith speaks like this. Do not say in your heart, who will go up to heaven? In other words, what can I do by climbing up to heaven? Work. That is to bring Christ down. Or who will go down into to abyss? That is to bring Christ up from the dead. In other words, all your works aren't going to bring the saving Jesus from heaven. And all your works are not going to rise him up from the dead. That has to be faith. You have faith in the incarnation and the resurrection. You have faith. Keeping your works is not going to make that happen. On the contrary, verse 8 in Romans 10, on the contrary, what does it say? The message is near you, in your mouth and in your heart. What does the scripture say? This is the message of faith that we proclaim. So, these verses are not meant to say that you keep the law and you live spiritually. Paul very clearly, after quoting Leviticus 18:5, saying that you'll keep the law and you'll live by that law, he then contrasts that with faith immediately. Same next three verses. So again, I say that these verses in the Old Testament is talking about keeping the law and you will live physically, temporally. Let's go to another New Testament scripture that takes this verse, which has a temporal reference in its original Old Testament context, but which is applied to spiritual life in the New Testament, Galatians 3:11-12. Now that no one is justified by the law before God is evident, for the righteous man shall live by faith. However, the law is not of faith. On the contrary, he who practices them shall live them. Again, that's a quote from our verse here, Leviticus 18:5. And Paul says, you practice the law, you live by law. But he's saying, that's not the way you live spiritually. You live by faith spiritually. So obviously, the original context of Leviticus 18:5 is not referring to spiritual life. It's referring to temporal life, physical life. Romans 7:10, Paul says this, and this commandment, which was to result in life, proved to result in death for me. So the law, keeping the law, results in death because you can't do it. All right, so let's go back to these Old Testament examples and show that if you live by the law, you'll live. If you keep the law, if you observe the law, you will live. That means physical, not spiritual life. Let's take Ezekiel 20:13 as one of these examples. But the house of Israel rebelled against me in the wilderness. They did not follow my statutes, and they rejected my ordinances. The person who does them will live by them. They also completely profaned my Sabbath, so I considered pouring out my wrath on them in the wilderness to put an end to them. The very end of verse 13, Exodus 20, God talks about physically putting an end to the Israelites. The New American Standard says annihilate them. That's talking about physical destruction. In contrast with the first part of the verse where it says the person who does them will live by them, that means you will physically live and not be physically annihilated. Context of the verse shows that clearly. Ezekiel 20:21, but the children rebelled against me. They did not follow my statutes or carefully keep my ordinances. The person who does them will live by them. Oh, what kind of life is promised there? Well, it's physical life. Going on in the same verse, Exodus 20, verse 21, they also profaned my Sabbaths. So I considered pouring out my wrath on them and exhausting my anger against them in the wilderness. That's not talking about sending somebody to hell. That's talking about wiping them out physically. So this is clear, this life that's talked about in the Old Testament in our verse here, Leviticus 18:5, as well as the associated Old Testament verses, is referring to natural physical life and not spiritual life. Jameson, the Fawcett, and Brown agrees with me here, or they agree with me here. Quote, obedience to the divine law always, indeed, ensures temporal advantages, my emphasis, temporal advantages, and this doubtless was the primary meaning, my emphasis, primary meaning of the words, which if a man do, he shall live in them. But that they had a higher reference to spiritual life is evident from the application made of them by our Lord. So not only does Paul quote this verse, he who does them will live by them, but so does Jesus. Luke 10:28. And he said to him, Jesus said to him, to whoever he was talking to, you have answered correctly. Do this and you will live. He's referring to Leviticus 18:5 and Exodus 20:11, the verses I just quoted, as the NASB note says. Jesus is quoting Leviticus 18:5, do this and you will live, but he's not talking about physical life. He's talking about spiritual life. He takes the Old Testament law, which has one meaning, and applies it and interprets it differently in the New Testament. We go down to Leviticus 18:6. You are not to come near any close relative for sexual intercourse. I am Yahweh. Now, here we get into the sexual perversions. And when it says come near, it doesn't mean that you're not to come near. That doesn't mean to avoid the company of a close relative. No, of course not, as John Gill points out. It's talking about having sex. Now, the close relative prohibition in verse 6 is basically a summary of the following laws against incest in verses 7 through 18, which we'll go through in pretty good detail. The prohibited degrees of consanguinity are specified from verses 7 through 17. We need to remember that at the beginning of mankind, some of these prohibited relations were allowed before the law came. This was because of the necessity of it. There wasn't anyone else to marry. There was a large gene pool back in patriarchal times, which allowed marriage between close relatives to occur with no problems of producing deformity, deformed kids. Now, what are some reasons why these prohibitions of unions within the prohibited boundaries of consanguinity, why were these relations not allowed at the time of the law? Adam Clark says it was impossible to fulfill double social duties. Quote, could a man be a brother and a husband, a son and a husband at the same time and fulfill the duties of both? Impossible. Well, that would screw your mind up pretty good, I would imagine. That's one reason. Another reason these laws against incest were passed or promulgated by the Lord is because social relations outside the family were strengthened. Here's what Clark says, quote, by intermarrying with other families, the bonds of social compact might be strengthened and extended. In other words, people won't be ingrown. Even in our culture, we know that ingrown means weak. So that the love of our neighbor, etc., might at once be felt to be not only a maxim of sound policy, but also a very practicable and easy duty, and thus feuds, divisions, and wars be prevented. Reminds me of medieval history, where the kings of Europe were constantly looking for marriage partners for their sons and daughters to make alliances to stop wars, because you're not going to fight your daughter-in-law or your son-in-law. The third reason why such relations were not allowed, incestuous relations were not allowed at the time of the law, was because the gene pool had shrunk by that time and you start getting physical deformities. We go now to Leviticus 18:7. You are not to shame your father by having sex with your mother. She is your mother. You must not have sexual intercourse with her. Well, now, you would think that's pretty obvious, but hey, apply this verse to Americans. There ain't no telling the limits to which Americans might go. Even in America today, this is sort of frowned upon. It's really interesting to me. Pagans, even though they are very fast and loose with sexual immorality, they do have limits. I remember one time on my history podcast, listening to my history podcast, my podcatcher popped up as an advertisement, an ad done by two women, and it had something to do with sexual mores in America. I can't remember what the name of it was, but I said, I'm going to listen to this. And they get up and they talk about all kinds of stuff that they do or don't do. And the theme was, what's your limit? how far will you go? And the podcaster host said, everybody has a line. And then they proceed to talk about the grossest stuff and this obvious sexually immoral stuff from a Christian point of view. But even from a totally pagan point of view, they said, I'm not going to go any further than that. And I thought that was interesting because there's still enough left of the image of God in fallen, sinful human beings to have a little bit of natural consciousness in them to know that there's certain things you ain't supposed to do. And this is one of them, having sex with your mother. My gosh. The NIV says that prohibition continued even after your father's death. Well, I would think so. I don't know how the NIV Study Bible knows that. Now, if the father was living and a son had sex with his mother, that would be immoral on two grounds. Adultery, because he's having sex with somebody, another man's wife, and he's having sex with his mother, so it would be incestuous, the second ground of immorality. I think the latter, to me, is worse than the former. We go now to Leviticus 18:8. That's just from feeling. I don't have any scripture to back that up. Leviticus 18:8, you're not to have sex with your father's wife. Now, in 18:7, it was your mother. Now, it's your father's wife. And you say, well, my father's wife is my mother. No, this is not referring to your natural mother. That was already referred to in verse 7. This is referring to a stepmother, assuming one exists, of course. It will shame your father. Gosh, you can imagine. You're having sex with your father's wife, your stepmother. That would happen in 1 Corinthians 5:1, if you recall. Paul writes to the Corinthians, it is actually reported that there is immorality among you, and immorality of such a kind as does not exist even among the Gentiles, that someone has his father's wife. So somebody was sleeping with his stepmother. And Paul says, even the pagans know that's wrong. As I said, even Americans would know that this is wrong. Leviticus 18:9 through 11, you are not to have sexual intercourse with your sister, either your father's daughter or your mother's daughter. Eat, whether born at home or born elsewhere, you're not to have sex with her. You're not to have sexual intercourse with your son's daughter or your daughter's daughter, because it will shame your family. You're not to have sexual intercourse with your father's wife's daughter, who is adopted by your father. She's your sister. Now, when you start getting into all these relations, it can get confusing real quick. I remember the discussions I had with my family members on, what's the difference now between a first cousin once removed and a second cousin? And I get it in my head, and I go to Google, and I got it all straight. As soon as my kinfolk walk out the door, I've forgotten what the difference is. And then I lived in China for 23 years, and oh my gosh, you think it's bad in America when you start talking about a bobo is your father's older brother, and a shushu is your father's younger brother, and a jojo is your sister's brother, whether older or younger, and that's just the beginning. I told myself years ago, I will not even attempt to come close to learning all the names of relations of Chinese people, especially when there are regional variations in those names. I talked to a Chinese girl one time on a bus, and she said that when she went to a family reunion or a family get-together, she immediately found some old auntie in there who knew everybody's relations. And she'd say, okay, now what do I call this guy? And what do I call this lady? And what do I call this guy? Because even the Chinese can't keep up with it. Well, this verse might sound that a little bit, but we're going to break it down to where it makes good sense. First of all, verse 9, you're not to have sexual intercourse with your sister. This is talking from the point of view of a man, but all these prohibitions, of course, would apply to a woman's relatives also. You just have to make the jump, the logical jump. That's not hard to do. You're not to have sexual intercourse with your sister. That's your natural blood sister born of one's father and your mother, as the commentator Matthew Poole says. And that's easy. Don't have sex with your sister. Well, I would hope that would be obvious. But now, the next next phrase in verse 9 says, you're not to have sexual intercourse either with your father's daughter or your mother's daughter. Well, what's your father's daughter? Isn't that your sister? No, that's your blood half-sister, as Matthew says. In other words, your father has a different wife, and then he impregnates her, and she has a baby. Well, that means that baby is your half, it's a baby girl, that baby is your half-sister. Now, to make this a little bit easier, I'm going to connect a couple of phrases up here. Your father's daughter is going to be the one that's born at home, as verse 9 says, and your mother's daughter is going to be the one born elsewhere. So how does this work? Well, if it's your father's daughter who is born at home, that would mean your father is a bigamist or a polygamist. He has another wife. He impregnates her with a baby girl. that baby girl is born, and now that baby is your half-sister. You share a father with the baby born at home. You're not supposed to have sex with her. Now, your mother's daughter would be the one that was born elsewhere. She would be married to somebody else outside the home, and that man would have died, or maybe she got divorced, and she had a child, a baby girl, a daughter, by that other father. And so she is brought into your father's household, and then your father impregnates her with you, so you're born. So now you share a mother with your half-sister. So these two cases are half-sisters, blood half-sisters, where in the first case you share the father, and that baby would be born at home. Or in the other case, you share a mother, and that baby girl would be born elsewhere before you were born, and you share the mother. So, to summarize that, half-sisters, by father and mother, it doesn't matter. Born at home or born elsewhere, it doesn't matter. You're not to have sex with her. Now, verse 10 says you're not to have sexual intercourse with your son's daughter. That's your granddaughter or your daughter's daughter. That's your son's daughter is your granddaughter on your son's side. Daughter's daughter is your granddaughter on your daughter's side. That should be obvious because it will shame your family, unless you're an American, of course. That's what we're coming to. Verse 11, you are not to have sexual intercourse with your father's wife's daughter, who is adopted by your father. She is your sister. All right, now we have a situation in verse 11 that refers to one's half-sister who's not a blood half-sister. We just talked about the blood half-sisters. Now we're talking about a father's wife's daughter. In this case, the woman would be brought in from another marriage. She would have a baby girl, a daughter by another marriage. And then one's father would marry her and then adopt her into the family, which happened a lot in this kind of cases. And so then your half-sister would be an adopted half-sister, not a blood half-sister. So you can't have sex with her either. So here's a summary of the sisters with whom sex is prohibited. Your blood full sister, your blood half-sisters, whether on your father or mother's side, or adopted half-sisters. Now, these cases are relatively easy cases of incest. This reminds me, I was living in Beijing. I had a friend there who had started a church, and he had this real dedicated brother and sister come to the church, and they were just in love with each other, and they wanted to get married, and they were first cousins. So he calls me up and asks me, what should I do? Well, the first problem I had was, is the Levitical law is not applicable to people today. Second problem I had was, there were times in the early South Carolina history where it was perfectly legal to marry your first cousin. Yeah, it has to be second cousins now, but back in the 1700s, it was first cousins, and I knew that. So I knew that the degrees of consanguinity were movable by legislatures. I also knew, or he told me, that the first cousin relationship was prohibited by Chinese law. That was a hard one. My final solution to that was, well, if it's against the law, they ought not to be doing it, because marriage is a social institution. You get married in Chinese society, and people find out that you're illegal. Your kids are going to find out that you're illegal. You're not going to get your hukous, your residential passports. You're not going to be allowed to enroll in schools. I mean, they already deprive you of all kind of rights anyway, and they find out that you're not legally married and, in fact, are ancestrally married. No, so I advised them against it. But this is the sort of thing that can come up. We're still in the easy relations now, though. And let's look at one of those, Leviticus 18, 12 through 14. You are not to have sexual intercourse with your father's sister. She is your father's close relative. That's your paternal aunt. Don't have sex with your paternal aunt, just like today, unless you're an American who thinks there are no sexual boundaries. Verse 13, you're not to have sexual intercourse with your mother's sister. That's your maternal aunt, for she is your mother's close relative. Verse 14, you are not to shame your father's brother. That's your uncle. By coming near his wife to have sexual intercourse, she is your aunt. That's an aunt by marriage and not by blood. But still, she's an aunt. Don't have sex with her. Now, notice that Moses' father, Amram, did do this. He married his aunt. Not Moses married his aunt. Moses' father, Amram, married his aunt. We see that in Exodus 6:20. Amram married his father's sister, Jochebed, Exodus 6:20 tells us. And she bore him Aaron and Moses. So Moses' great aunt was also his mother. Well, the rules were different before the law. Remember, the boundaries of consanguinity were much broader than before the law. Bigger gene pool. Now in verse 14, if you shamed your father's brother by marrying his wife or having intercourse with his wife, well, now you've done two things. First of all, you've committed adultery because you're not married to your father's brother's wife, your paternal uncle's wife. You're not married to her. And obviously, you're committing incest too. Now, here's an interesting question. What happens if the father's brother has died and the wife is now free? She's a widow. Can you marry your father's brother's wife? The NIV Study Bible says no, the law still prohibits that. I don't know how they know that. I can imagine it would mess up family relations pretty good if you did that, but I don't really know. It might be illegal according to your state's law also. The NIV Study Bible says such a marriage, a dead father's brother's wife, that marriage could be rationalized as legitimate because the aunt was not a blood relative. You don't have any deformity gene problems there, but it was nonetheless forbidden according to the NIV Study Bible. Well, now, notice that this sounds very similar to a levirate marriage, where if you had a brother who was dead, you could marry that brother's surviving wife. Here you've got an uncle who's dead. Why could you not marry the uncle's surviving wife? Well, the levirate law complicates things a little bit. We'll talk about that in just a minute. It just is. I think it's easier to interpret the law this way. You're not to marry your father's brother's wife, whether you're father's brother, your paternal uncle, is dead or alive. It doesn't matter. Stay away from his wife. I think in these matters, better be safe than sorry. You better err on the side of being conservative. We go down to Leviticus 18, 15, and 16. You're not to have sexual intercourse with your daughter-in-law. Well, that's a no-brainer. She is your son's wife. You are not to have sex with her. You're not to have sexual intercourse with your brother's wife. That's your sister-in-law. It will shame your brother. So no sex with daughters-in-laws and sister-in-laws. Now, the law applied whether the brother was living. You can't marry a living brother's wife, obviously. If the brother is divorced, you can't marry a divorced brother's wife. NIV Study Bible says so. Gill says, though, again, I don't know how they say that, how they can back that up. And if the brother is dead, you still can't marry your brother's wife. NIV Study Bible and John Gill says even when the brother's dead and had issue, you're not supposed to marry your brother's wife. Well, right now, this is where we bump up against the levirate law, because the levirate law not only allows you to marry your dead brother's wife who has children, who does not have issue, you're not only allowed to marry her, you're required to marry her. Well, let's read the levirate law. It's in Deuteronomy 25, verses 5 through 6. When brothers live together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the deceased shall not be married outside the family to a strange man. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her to himself as wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. It shall be that the firstborn whom she bears shall assume the name of his dead brother so that his name will not be blotted out from Israel. So there was a levirate law. You are forced to marry your dead brother's wife if that dead brother doesn't have any sons and thus would lose. The family name would die out. You got to keep the family name going. Well, how do you reconcile those two laws? This is the way both John Gill and Adam Clark reconcile the two laws. They say the law in Leviticus here just means that you can't, the brother cannot marry the widow of his deceased brother. However, there's an exception to that general rule. If that deceased brother dies without issue, then another law comes into effect, namely the levirate law, Deuteronomy 25:5. That's the easiest way to reconcile it. Adam Clark says, this was an illegal marriage, i.e. to marry your deceased brother's wife is an illegal marriage unless the brother died childless. In that case, it was not only lawful for her to marry her brother-in-law, but he was obliged by the law, the levirate law, Deuteronomy 25:5, to take her to wife. So that's how we're going to reconcile it. Now, this levirate law is a can of worms. I've got a nice website here that goes all into it. If you want to get a PhD in biblical studies, you might want to study this issue. Some people say the levirate law applies even when the deceased brother has kids. Then the surviving brother needs to marry his sister-in-law so he can take care of the nephews because they were small, even though the deceased father might have left them some estate. He was young when he died. He probably didn't have a lot of money, and so the surviving brothers got to take care of him. And that's interesting. Well, we're not going to get into that. I'm just going to take it simply. You don't have sex with your brother's wife unless she dies without issue. Then you're forced to marry her and then have sex with her to produce heirs and offspring. We go now to Leviticus 18, verses 17 and 18. You're not to have sexual intercourse with a woman and her daughter. You're not to marry her son's daughter or her daughter's daughter and have sex with her. They are close relatives. It is depraved. Oh, I love that word, depraved. You say that somebody's having sex with a horse, you say, hey, you're depraved. Oh, you're intolerant. You're a bigot. You're trying to push your religion on me. You're trying to put your morality on me. I can hear them now. Verse 18, you're not to marry a woman as a rival to her sister and have sexual intercourse with her during her sister's lifetime, during her lifetime. Now, you're not to have sexual intercourse with a woman and her daughter. That woman, of course, would be one's wife. It's illicit, it's illegal to have sex with a woman that you're not married to. So, in other words, you marry a woman, you don't have sex with the woman's daughter. NIV Study Bible says that law applied even after the woman had died. You don't have sex with the daughter. And again, I don't know how they say that. A woman and her daughter, that would be one's stepdaughter. And of course, a fortiori, the prohibition would apply to one's natural daughter. Of course, you don't do that. I think the way it's phrased, he's referring to stepdaughters here. I think it goes without saying, your natural daughter, but he's talking about a stepdaughter here by saying a woman and her daughter. If he was talking about a natural daughter, the text would have just said, don't have intercourse with your daughter. But he didn't do that. He said a woman and her daughter. Sounds like the woman brought the daughter in from a previous marriage. And if the woman had brought in a son or a daughter from a previous marriage, and that son or daughter had had offspring by getting married and having kids, well, you ain't supposed to have sex with their offspring. I would call that a step-grandson or a step-granddaughter. I made the word up. I don't know if it's true. The NIV Study Bible called it a granddaughter-in-law. I don't know about all these names for relatives. I just don't do it. Now, verse 18 says, you are not to marry a woman as a rival to her sister. In other words, you're not supposed to marry your sister-in-law. Now, of course, that refers to the times of polygamy. Obviously, you can't do that now because you'd be a bigamist. But if you're a polygamist and it's legal to have more than one wife, and you're already married to one woman and you find another woman that's her sister, don't marry the sister. There's going to be conflict. We have a great biblical example of that. Remember, Jacob married two sisters. He married Leah, and then he married Rachel. And by the way, this is two sisters that are still living, because it explicitly says here, you're not to have sexual intercourse with her during her sister's lifetime. They're still living. Now, if they die, you can marry sisters if one of them dies. Now, why some prohibitions against marrying sisters at the same time in a polygamous relationship? First of all, John Gill says a man would be a father and uncle to his own children. The children would be both brothers and cousins at the same time. Okay, so what? Why would that be a problem? I guess it'd be a problem at family reunions. To avoid family jealousies, I think, is the main reason, as in the case of Rachel and Leah. Some say this is a prohibition against polygamy. No, it's a prohibition against a particular kind of polygamy, marrying sisters. The law allowed polygamy everywhere else. We go now to Leviticus 18:19. You're not to come near a woman during her menstrual impurity to have sexual intercourse with her. Now, this woman, of course, is talking about your wife, because you're not going to be coming near a woman that's not your wife. That's illegal on other grounds. Any other woman would be illegal and immoral. So it's your wife. Don't have sex with your wife while she's having a period, is what this says. Now, let's look at some other scriptures talking about menstruation and menstrual impurity. Leviticus 15:19. When a woman has a discharge, if her discharge in her body is blood, she shall continue in her menstrual impurity for 7 days, and whoever touches her shall be unclean until evening. Now, this referred to having sex with a woman who is menstruating and the husband doesn't know it. It's an accident. Menstruation starts in the middle of intercourse. In other words, he's unclean or she's unclean for 7 days, and whoever touches her is merely unclean until evening. That would be her husband. Then in Leviticus 20:18, we see the case where a man deliberately has sex with his menstruous wife. If there's a man who lies with a menstruous woman and uncovers her nakedness, that means has sex with her, he has laid bare her flow, and she has exposed the flow of her blood. Thus, both of them shall be cut off from among their people. Now, cut off is either exiled or killed, executed, judicially executed. Serious business there. Exodus 18:6 says this, dot, 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 and does not eat at the mountain shrines or lift up his eyes to the idols of the house of Israel or defile his neighbor's wife or approach a woman during her menstrual period. This is somebody who's a good guy. He doesn't have sex with his neighbor's wife. He doesn't do idolatry. He doesn't have sex with his wife when she's menstruating. Exodus 22:10, men within you have sexual intercourse with their father's wife and violate women during their menstrual impurity. All right, now all of this impurity is not talking about moral impurity. It's talking about ceremonial impurity, Levitical impurity. It just means you can't go to the temple when you menstruate. It doesn't mean you're immoral because you're having a period. Now, what are some of the reasons why sex with menstruating women was ceremonially unclean? Here's the first option. It's a crazy one. It's from Adam Clark. Remember, he's writing in the 1800s when they didn't have a lot of knowledge of medicine. He says this: we want to protect the offspring of this man and woman, this menstruating woman. Her children might be diseased if she has the baby when she has sex during a period. Here's what Clark says, quote, "The common sense of all mankind has led them to avoid the gross impropriety referred to in this verse, and it has been a general opinion that offspring obtained in this way has been infected with leprous, scrofulous, and other deeply eradicated diseases from which they and their posterity have been scarcely ever freed." In other words, from generation to generation, you're going to have scrofula or leprosy or whatever eradicated disease is because you have sex during a period. Well, that's nonsense, but it's kind of funny. Second reason why one should not have sex with a menstruating woman when she is ceremonially unclean, and that makes you ceremonially unclean. Well, to show respect for blood. And this is the real reason. The whole Levitical system is based on blood sacrifices. Here's a quote from answers.yahoo.com. Quote, it is important to remember the purpose of the Old Testament laws concerning blood. In the sacrificial system, blood was sacred. Leviticus 17:11. Life is in the blood. Our favorite verse that we quoted last chapter. Blood was sacred. A woman's uncleanliness during her period was symbolic of the value placed on blood. So there's your answer. Now, I've mentioned this before, but I guess I was traumatized by it. I had a friend, a couple, who were giving a lecture on natural family planning, which is how to not have babies or to have babies depending on what you desired, by regulating what days that you had sex. It was kind of a sophisticated rhythm method. It had rhythm plus two other indicators to figure out when you were fertile and when you were not. And the presenter put the PowerPoint of a chart on the board that showed a woman's and a husband's times of the month that they had sex. And that was indicated by an X. And one of the X's was during the menstrual period. And one of the women in the audience, she got all upset. How dare can you say that she's having sex? This woman on that had this chart is having sex with her husband during her period. She's a horrible sinner, and how can you say that this is all right? And oh my gosh. I don't remember exactly how my friend answered that, but I've got a great answer to it right here from gotquestions.org. I'm going to read it. Quote, as a result of these scriptures, namely these scriptures in Leviticus that say it's not right to have sex with a menstruating woman, as a result of these scriptures, some hold that a married couple should not have sex while the wife is having her period. The problem with this view is that if the scriptures are applied consistently, even touching a woman who's having her menstrual flow would be forbidden. You remember in the Levitical law, you couldn't touch a woman when she's menstruating. You couldn't even touch what she was sitting on. Further, the quotation goes on, according to Leviticus 15, verses 20 through 23, even touching something that the woman has also touched would be forbidden. Do these laws apply to us today? No, they do not. Why? It is important to remember the purpose of the Old Testament laws concerning blood. In the sacrificial system, blood was sacred. Leviticus 17:11, that favorite verse. A woman's uncleanness during her period was symbolic of the value placed on blood. As a result, contact with a woman who was having her period was forbidden. Christians today are not under the Old Testament ceremonial law. There no longer is a sacrificial system. Jesus' blood sacrifice paid the penalty for sins once and for all. The Levitical ceremonial laws do not apply today. There is no biblical reason why a married couple cannot have sex during the wife's period. Cue
Q-E-D, quid est demonstratum. I tell you, it's amazing when Christians get under the law and come up with all kind of screwy stuff. Leviticus 18:20-21, you shall not have intercourse with your neighbor's wife to be defiled with her. You shall not give any of your offspring to offer them to Molech, nor shall you profane the name of your God. I am the Lord. Verse 20, you shall not have intercourse with your neighbor's wife. That reminds me of an old country song back in the 70s by a singer who was not very well known. I forgot his name, actually, but he had a great song. He says, don't anyone make love at home anymore. Does everyone possess the urge to cheat? That was the 1970s. Of course, having intercourse with your neighbor's wife not only violated the Levitical laws, it violated the Ten Commandments. The seventh commandment, Exodus 20:14, you shall not commit adultery. Proverbs 6:32 says, the one who commits adultery with a woman is lacking sense. He's a moron. He who would destroy himself does it. You want to ruin your life? Now, if you say, well, how can you say that? Well, watch the biographies of people who committed adultery. Look at Napoleon when he ditched his wife for another woman for political reasons. Watch Lifetime movies. Read novels. Adultery does not pay, folks. It leads to murder. It leads to strife. It leads to pain. Now, verse 21 says, you should not give any of your offspring to offer them to Molech. Now, who was Molech? Molech was an Ammonite god, and he was famous for having babies sacrificed to that god. And, of course, the Israelites would run into that, and they're not supposed to sacrifice their offspring. That should go without saying. We could make an application today. Oh, the law now says that a doctor cannot advise a kid against taking sex change drugs before puberty. And if the doctor tries to advise against that, the law comes after him and says he's discriminating, violating that child's human rights. And so the doctor says, okay, we'll let you do it. Is that not sacrificing our offspring to Molech? Look at all the people who are detransitioning from their sex change operations. They're sorry they did it. No, but the moronic press in this country, the moronic professors who run the universities, the moronic people who run the media, they're going to say, oh, that's so, you're such a bigot. You don't want to have people freedom to change their sex. I mean, on innocent little kids who don't have a choice in this, they're being fed these type of drugs. There ain't no difference between that and taking your kid or sacrificing it on a golden altar. But at any rate, that's application. Let's go back to the immediate interpretation. Does this mean, when it says to offer your child to Molech, does it mean that the child is killed? Well, there's a dispute about that. Let's look at Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, who talk about the death of the child and the interpretation that the child is actually offered as a sacrifice. Quote, his, that's Molech's, statue was of brass and rested on a pedestal or throne of the same metal. His head, resembling that of a calf, was adorned with a crown, and his arms were extended in the attitude of embracing those who approached him. His devotees dedicated their children to him, and when this was to be done, they heated the statue to a high pitch of intensity by a fire within. And then the infants were either shaken over the flames or passed through the ignited arms by way of lustration to ensure the favor of the pretended deity. Lustration is an expiatory sacrifice of fire. So they either shake the baby over the flames or pass them through the arms, which are burning now, and I assume that would kill the baby. But now John Gill mentions that some say that the offering to Molech was a little short of child sacrifice. Quote, this is John Gill quoting this, saying this, quote, yet this seems to be something short of that and to be done in the matter, as Jarchi and other Jewish writers relate, who say the father delivered his sons to the priest of Molech, and they made two great fires, and caused the son to pass on foot between the two fires, which was a kind of lustration, an expiatory sacrifice by burning. So walking between the two fires was a kind of a lustration, and so of a dedication of them to the idol. Though it must be owned that both were done, yea, that both the phrases of passing through the fire and of burning are used promiscuously of the same. So he quotes from 2 Kings 16:30, 2 Chronicles 28:3, and Ezekiel 16:20 is showing that it's not just walking between two burning fires, it's actually putting the child in the fire. They might be done at different times, walking through the two fires or putting the child into one fire, or the one previous and in order to the other. In other words, serially, you walk him through two fires and then you put him in the fire. And perhaps they might cause the child so often and so long to pass through the fire that at last it was burnt and destroyed. In other words, they just wave it over the fire, and the kid doesn't die immediately, but sooner or later he's burned up. I'm sure that's what's going on, and it's horrible. Of course, they're not supposed to do it. Now, who was this Molech that required children to be sacrificed to him? He was the god of the Ammonites. Remember, Ammon is to the east of the Dead Sea in the northern east of the bottom end of the Jordan River as it enters into the Dead Sea, and also to the east of the northern top of the Dead Sea. That's Ammon. Present-day Jordan, in other words. Ammon is the capital of Jordan. That's where it gets its names from, the Ammonites. Well, let's look at Molech, Leviticus 20, verses 2 through 5. You shall also say to the sons of Israel, any man from the sons of Israel or from the aliens sojourning in Israel who gives any of his offspring to Molech shall surely be put to death. The people of the land shall stone him with stones. I will also set my face against that man, and I will cut him off from among his people, because he has given some of his offspring to Molech, so as to defile my sanctuary and to profane my holy name. If the people of the land, however, should ever disregard that man when he gives any of his offspring to Molech, so as to not put him to death, then I myself will set my face against that man and against his family, and I will cut off from among their people both him and all those who play the harlot after him by playing the harlot after Molech. In other words, Israelites, you kill him, and if you don't get him, I'm going to get him. Bad business. 2 Chronicles 33:6. He, this is King Manasseh, evil king, made his sons pass through the fire in the valley of Ben-Hinnom. That's the trash dump valley south of the Tyre-Pernean Valley in Jerusalem. And he, that's Manasseh, practiced witchcraft, used divination, practiced sorcery, and dealt with mediums and spiritists. He did much evil. Yeah. In addition, he passed his sons through the fire. And I'm assuming that means he killed them. Child sacrifice. 2 Kings 23:10. He, Manasseh, also defiled Topheth, which is in the valley of the son of Hittim, that no man might make his son or his daughter pass through the fire for Molech. I guess he'd repented there of child sacrifice. Topheth is a place in the valley of Hinnom where the child sacrifice was done. Jeremiah 32:35. They built the high places of Baal that are in the valley of Ben-Hinnom to cause their sons and their daughters to pass through the fire to Molech. So right there in the trash dump, they put up these pagan altars to Molech and sacrificed their kids on them. The verse goes on later to call that an abomination. Now, sacrificing children to Molech was popular in Phoenicia, right north of Israel on the Mediterranean coast, and other surrounding countries, as the NIV Study Bible says. Well, that should be obvious. Don't sacrifice your kids to the fire. Leviticus 18:22-23. You shall not lie with a male as one lies with a female. It is an abomination. Also, you shall not have intercourse with any animal to be defiled with it, nor shall any woman stand before an animal to mate with it. It is a perversion. Well, not in America, it's not. Gay Pride. Pride Month is now starting. The San Francisco Giants have now put rainbow logos on their uniform to celebrate sexual perversion. Folks, in the Old Testament, the penalty for homosexuality was death. I know we don't live in the Old Testament anymore, but the New Testament is also opposed to homosexuality. Romans 13, I'll quote you those verses in a minute. But let's jump over to Leviticus 20:13, and we'll see that the penalty for homosexuality was death. If there is a man who lies with a male as those who lie with a woman, both of them have committed a detestable act. They shall surely be put to death. Their blood guiltiness is upon them. Ooh, serious business. Now, the penalty for homosexuality in the New Testament was not death as it was in Leviticus, but it was still condemned as degrading by Paul in Romans 1:26-27, for example. This is why God delivered them over to degrading passions. For even their females exchanged natural sexual relations for unnatural ones. The males in the same way also left natural relations with females or were inflamed in their lust for one another. Males committed shameless acts with males and received in their own persons the appropriate penalty of their error. So homosexuality is called degrading, it's called shameless. People who do it are going to receive penalty in their own body. And there it is, just as plain as day. And of course, our culture totally rejects Paul, rejects the scriptures, rejects God, rejects Jesus, and says that nothing wrong with homosexuality, no problem. I remember I did a talk in China, and I did it once again in a small group in America on homosexuality and recorded it and put it up on sermon audio. And the number of hits on that thing actually beat out John MacArthur for a day. I couldn't believe it. It's a hot topic. But I remember in that talk, I discussed how that the homosexual community started out by saying that homosexuality was a preference, not an orientation. And they decided to not use that terminology anymore because when you say homosexuality is a preference, you're saying it's a choice and that people therefore can choose to sin. But if it's an orientation, you're born that way and you can't help it. Therefore, you're not morally liable if you end up in a homosexual lifestyle. Well, I went to all the research, got all the articles, went to Wikipedia even. Where does homosexuality come from? Is it determined at birth? Well, there was a gentleman, a homosexual guy, who claimed very famously that homosexuality was hardwired into a person when he was born. He later had to renounce his own research because it was flawed as it could be and was very easy to show the flaws. And in fact, he got up on Phil Donahue and repudiated his own research. And since that happened, there has been no proof that homosexuality is hardwired into your genes. Now, maybe you're predisposed to it, but like some people are predisposed to alcohol, that doesn't mean they can't stop doing it. Well, I can't tell you how many times people say, well, they can't help it, they're just born that way. Baloney sausage. They're not just born that way. They choose to be that way. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a sin. As Paul very clearly says, it is a sin here. Now, it's interesting how people will try, liberals, will try to get around these homosexual verses because they want to hold on to Christianity, but they don't want to hold on their homosexuality too, and so they try to mix oil and water. I saw this Yale history professor who said, Paul here is condemning heterosexuals who decide to go against their natural heterosexual orientation, the way that God made them, and they go over there and experiment with homosexuality. But this verse does not apply to people who are born as homosexuals and then who want to practice homosexuality, which, of course, is utter and absolute nonsense. It's not even worth refuting. It's so stupid. But that's the way people are these days. I'm going to tell you something. You want to love a homosexual, the first thing you need to do is say, hey, buddy, you need to get out of what you're doing because it's going to destroy you, either physically or spiritually. Either one, you're dying. I remember in preparing that little talk I did, looking at the health problems that homosexuals have, and the sources I had were using the homosexual literature. I forgot the name of the famous homosexual publication. And they just went through that and looked at all the articles that talked about all the horrible diseases, especially tuberculosis, and not to mention AIDS, that homosexuals were dealing with. They have a horrible life expectancy, and people say, well, the homosexual advocacy, people say, well, that's because people are always looking down on them, and they have all this social pressure. And no, because homosexuality has been legalized for a long time, gay pride parades everywhere, especially in European countries, and they still have high death rates and high degrees of unhealthiness. Folks, look at a picture of a man standing up naked and a woman standing up naked and tell me, how do the parts fit? That's a simple, I mean, it's just ridiculous. Homosexuality kills. I had a roommate who was a homosexual, and he died at the age of 40 after going out to San Francisco and sporting about, and he's dead now. He was a great guy. He was a good friend of mine, and he was decent enough not to try to push his homosexuality on us, on me and his fellow mutual friends. Well, it's a terrible tragedy. If I'd have known about it, I didn't know he was homosexual at the time. He hadn't come out of the closet when I was a roommate with him. But if I'd have known about it, I hope I would have said something to him and said, hey, you need to stop this. It's going to kill you. Now, verse 23 talks about bestiality. Also, you shall not have intercourse with any animal. Here's a good quote from John Gill, who quotes Herodotus. Quote, Herodotus reports of his own knowledge that a goat had carnal copulation with a woman openly in the view of all in his time. And though that creature is a most lascivious and lustful one, yet, as Bocart from Plutarch has observed, when it is provoked by many and beautiful women, is not inclined and ready to come into their embraces, but shows some abhorrence of it. Nature in brutes, as that learned man observes, is often more prevalent in them than in mankind. In other words, even a goat knows you're not supposed to have sex with a woman. But unfortunately, there's a lot of human beings that think it's perfectly all right to have sex with animals. Of course, I guess that's the next thing that's coming. After polygamy and incest, bestiality, oh, what's right for you is right for you. What's right for me is right for me. Don't make a law against it. Or if they do have a law against it, what they'll say is, this is cruelty to animals. I think I have seen that somewhere. Our culture is so utterly perverted, it's almost hopeless to even talk to anybody that's bought into it. I remember one time I was a member of a Presbyterian church, a dead Presbyterian church in which Very few of the members were actually saved, and it was just an organization. It was an abomination, one of those things that God's going to spew out of his mouth one day. And I went off to a youth group meeting, retreat, I should say, in that church. And I remember a guy, I still remember that guy. I remember where he's from. I remember his red hair. I forgot his name, but he was a lot, older than me, bigger than me. And he's bragging about how he had just had sex with a horse there at the retreat. And I said, this is Christianity? Please. Leviticus 18, verses 24 through 28. Do not defile yourselves by any of these things, for by all these the nations which I am casting out before you have become defiled. That's all the Canaanites getting booted. For the land has become defiled, therefore I have brought its punishment upon it, so the land has spewed out its inhabitants. By the way, there's so many liberals out there who say, oh, this terrible God, he committed genocide. He's killing all those Canaanites, all those sweet and innocent Canaanites. No, they were perverts, folks. They were child murderers. They were offering their children to Molech. They were having sex with animals. They were homosexuals. They were all that stuff. Verse 26, but as for you, you are to keep my statutes and my judgments, and shall not do any of these abominations, neither the native nor the alien who sojourns among you. For the men of the land who have been before you have done all these abominations, and the land has become defiled. That includes homosexuality, folks, and bestiality. They defile the land with their sexual immorality. Application point, how about America? Is our land defiled? I'll leave that up to you. Verse 28, don't do all these things. Verse 28, so that the land will not spew you out, should you defile it, as it has spewed out the nation which has been before you. And as a matter of fact, the Israelites did do all that stuff, and they got spewed out. In 722, the northern 10 tribes did when the Assyrians came in and wiped them out. And then in 586 BC, when the Babylonians got the southern two tribes, the Israelites got spewed out. Being spewed out, John Gill and Adam Clark say, refers to sins which are like bad food, which the stomach vomits back out. If you ever had food poisoning, whew, there ain't nothing worse. That's what sin's like. I remember I had food poisoning one time. I was double over in agony, wishing I was dead, begging God to just go ahead and take me to heaven now because I couldn't stand it another microsecond. I was outside of a restaurant in Shanghai, at which I foolishly ate an American salad which had not been cooked. I was told not to do that. I was an idiot. I did it anyway. That's what sin is like. Sin of a nation will make the nation vomit. It'll spew out the inhabitants. Now, an interesting point here in verse 28, so that the land will not spew you out, should you defile it as it has spewed out the nation which has been before you. How has the land spewed out Canaan? It hasn't happened yet. The Israelites are on their way. They haven't gotten there yet. So why the past tense? John Gill says this quote, for the certainty of it is spoken as done, though it was as yet future. I used to think that was a stretch, but I don't think so anymore. I think that makes sense. You're finished, Canaan. You are finished. Well, actually, they're not finished yet. We do that in English even. I'm a dead man. Well, nobody can say I'm a dead man because they're not dead yet, but what it means is it's so certain that I might as well say it's here now. So this spewing out was so certain that God telling Moses that it's as good as done. It's the Canaanites are spewed out. We go now to Leviticus 18, verses 29 and 30, the last two verses of our chapter. For whoever does any of these abominations, those persons who do so shall be cut off from among their people. Thus you are to keep my charge that you do not practice any of the abominable customs which have been practiced before you, so as not to defile yourselves with them. I am the Lord your God. Again, you shall be cut off as either death or banishment. Jameson Fawcett Brown is very opinionated on this, or very certain on this. He says, quote, death is the punishment sternly denounced against all of them. No language could be more explicit or universal. None could more strongly indicate intense loathing and abhorrence. And I think he's right. You're going to die if you do all things, including homosexuality, by the way. All of these abominations, including homosexuality. You know, when I was young, I wouldn't have bothered to make that emphasis. But today, we live in a different world, so I'm emphasizing it. Homosexuality was included as an abomination. So if you're going to be a Christian and a homosexual at the same time, you should think again. Now, I will say this. I know that homosexuality is a tough, tough, tough sin to get free of, and we need to be sympathetic with homosexuals who are struggling against it because it totally warps a person's nature when you start messing with their sexuality. And by the way, Isn't it kind of interesting that transgender advocates now say that a child or a human can choose their gender without regard to their sexuality, without regard to their gender? But homosexuals can't. They're born that way. They can't change it. It seems to me that's just a little bit contradictory. Now, verse 30 says, "Do not practice any of the abominable customs which have been practiced before you." That means by the Canaanites before the Israelites got there. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with Leviticus 18, 29 through 30. In our next audio, we will turn to Leviticus 19, verses 1 through 31 or 37. We will entitle that section, "The Law is Holy and Love Your Neighbor as Yourself." I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.